Welcome to the How the Why. With John Barrett Ingalls. Exploring and celebrating the creative process and the creative purpose of authors, editors, artists, and publishers that make up and inspire the 1888 family. 1888 serves as a regional catalyst for the preservation, presentation, and promotion of cultural heritage and literary arts. Let's get creative.
Hello, and welcome to the How, the Why, brought to you by 1888. My name is John Barrett Ingalls, and today we are connected with David Yulin, who is graciously one of the judges for 1888's Plaza Literary Prize, writer, former book reviewer for the LA Times, and a lover of words. I just threw that in. I'm assuming that's true.
Yeah, I think we can say that's true.
Well, David, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure. Delighted to be here.
I like saying talk to us, even though it's just me in a room by myself. But, you know, at some point there will be others who are participating. So I'd like to start with that first moment in the life of David Yulin where story and language and the written word excited you?
Well, I think it starts with story, probably even before writing or reading. And, you know, I always loved stories. I loved telling them. I loved hearing them. I was very, very close when I was young, really young, you know, like 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, with my grandfather, my mother's father, and he was a kind of voracious storyteller. He had been early in his life a kind of, I don't know, semi-professional writer, you know, had written some things here and there. It wasn't what he pursued for a career, but he told stories, and he told me a lot of stories, and I loved listening to his stories. And I think in some way, the kind of storytelling impulse or that sort of intimacy of storytelling, you know, the idea that there's a storyteller who is telling you a story, you get caught up in the narrative, but it's also a kind of a conversation, a back and forth. I kind of think that it dates from, you know, that early exposure to him and to his stories. But as far as the written part of it, you know, I learned to read early. I always kind of loved to read. I grew up in a house that was full of books. My father was and still is a voracious reader. So there were thousands of, you know, big bookshelves. I remember being, you know, 6 or 7 years old and kind of scaling these floor-to-ceiling bookshelves that were in my parents' living room and looking at the books. And my father had, you know, I don't think it was this clearly articulated, but he had what was essentially an open shelf policy. So anything that was on his shelves, nothing was ever restricted. You know, I could read, I was encouraged to look at anything I wanted, to read anything I wanted. There was no question of what was appropriate or wasn't. So books from a very early moment felt to me like a kind of wide open and really sort of interesting or exciting universe that I wanted to be part of. And it, I think in that way it kind of grew. It developed in other ways as I got older, but that I think that those are the two initial impulses.
And what about seeking it out as a career, both as a critic and as a writer yourself?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, again, growing out of that experience, you know, at a certain point, also probably fairly young, 7, maybe 8, whenever I first got the realization that books were not just objects that existed in the world, but that somebody actually made books, you know, that that could be your job, I wanted to do it. So I would tell you, at the risk of sounding kind of loony, that I decided or began to self-identify as a writer as early as second or third grade. Certainly third, probably second. You know, I think I wrote my first so-called book when I was in second grade. It was a biography of my pet hamster. You know, I bound it by stapling the pages together and, you know, proudly presented it to my family. But I think in some weird protean way, I was already self-consciously imagining myself as a writer and imagining my relationship to the world through that lens at that age. I had absolutely no idea what that what that would mean. So it's a weird thing to think about in terms of a career. I mean, it did become a career. It has become a career. But when I first started imagining it as a kid, it was, again, it was kind of exciting and a fantasy. And partly it had to do with the fact of, you know, what a great thing if you could actually, I think even at that age, I knew I wasn't cut out for a straight job. So, you know, what a great thing if you could be part of this. And I think there was also this sense of being in conversation with the writers that I loved, and criticism, you know, so I kept writing. I mean, I always wrote and always identified as a writer, and criticism, I think, kind of just grew out of that process of thinking about books, of reading books. I was reading critically as a young writer, you know, in my teens and 20s before I ever became a professional critic, trying to dissect what writers were doing, trying to figure out how they were doing what they did so I could sort of apply it to my own writing. I'd been an English major in college. I liked critical writing because I liked, it required me to think more deeply about books and how they worked, and then allowed me to kind of develop or construct an aesthetic of my own. And so for my entire professional life, but probably dating before that, I've always seen I always see criticism as a profoundly creative act in the first place, but I see a very strong relationship between, for me at least, between the critical and the creative impulse. They're always in conversation with each other.
Now, you worked for the LA Times, and you've edited and written multiple books about Los Angeles, but it's not your, is this your city? Like, is this the city of the youth, or is it become the adopted city that
it's,
you've grown
you know,
to
it's it's complicated. I would say at this point I don't have a city, or I have several cities. You know, I was born and raised in New York, and New York was a big part of my family's mythos, right? I mean, a lot of those early stories that I was talking about that my grandfather told me had to do with his upbringing in New York. He was an immigrant, but he came over as a kid, as like an 8-year-old kid. So a lot of his stories were about kind of, you know, being a young man in New York. And so there was always a sort of mythic lure to New York. And I love New York. I still love New York. It's, you know, it's a city. It's my hometown. It's a city where I came to some sense of cities and some sense of identity. The city of my youth, you know, in some ways is probably San Francisco, where I lived when I was 18 for a brief but fairly intense period, and at you know, sort of first blush of adult independence. And then Los Angeles becomes a kind of adopted city. I moved here, I've been here almost 25 years. I don't see myself going anywhere. But in some ways, all three of those cities and other cities that I've lived in kind of circle each other in my own imagination. At this point, I've come to think that I don't really have a city I either have all of these cities or I don't really have a city. They, you know, that in some ways I kind of have created a hybrid version of all of them that, you know, as I said, that sort of fits in my imagination, and that I kind of write or think about cities from out of that territory.
Now, do you have any, because of so many of your works do center around Los Angeles, and then you have Labyrinth, which goes to San Francisco, is there any urge to write stories about New York?
I've written stories about New York. I don't, at this point, I'm sure I will write about New York at some point. I mean, there are a couple of projects that revolve around New York. I don't really think about the writing in terms of, I mean, I think place is very important to writing, and obviously I have written and edited a lot of books about Los Angeles, which partly grew out of an impulse that, you know, again, going back to the reading impulse, one of the ways that I make sense of things is to read about them. So when I first thought about moving to Los Angeles, which was in the late 1980s, I began to read everything I could get about the city, just so I could get a sense of where I'd been here as a visitor, but I didn't really have a great understanding of what the city was or how it operated. So I began to read a lot of books, and in the process, I became aware of the fact that there was this very rich and vibrant literary culture, which nobody was writing about and nobody was really talking about, not even in the city itself. It was a kind of shadow culture in a certain sense. Sort of constitutionally, I'm drawn to those sorts of things, whether they have to do with literature or, you know, politics or sociology. I like the idea of stuff that is kind of existing on the fringes or under the radar in some way. And so I got drawn into writing about the literary culture of Los Angeles because it was it felt like extremely uncharted territory, and it was really interesting. And so in that sense, there's kind of an organic process. It wasn't a conscious process. And the same thing happened in terms of the broader sort of writing about the city. Once I got here, I realized I didn't know anything about, you know, about the city's history, about the city's expansion, about how the city developed, any of these kinds of things. So I began to sort of look into it just because I was curious and I was interested. And then that generated the kind of writing about the city really as a way of kind of, as a kind of act of cartography in a certain sense, as a way of mapping out my relationship to the place. But the impulse wasn't necessarily like, oh, I'm going to write about Los Angeles. It was just sort of material that I was immersed in and that I kind of, you know, felt I had to figure out how to resolve. So in many ways, the impulse to write, you know, those ideas get generated more from something that's like a, it's like an itch that I can't quite figure out how to scratch. So the writing becomes a process by which I start to scratch it.
Yeah, and I feel like Los Angeles has gone through multiple iterations, and because it's so spread out, there's this, it's almost like, I know somebody drew this map recently of like all the other major cities in the United States and how they would fit into the larger Los Angeles, because it's these multiple areas and they all have their different life, different vibrancy and different stories. You know, I've been here for maybe 15 years and I'm still discovering all the different hidden gems and stories. And I don't know if you'll ever take that all, take it all.
No, I mean, I, you know, just last night, actually, to tell you the truth, I was in downtown. I was driving my son to Union Station, and a lot of the roads were closed because they're building the regional connector, the, you know, to the subway. And, you know, I discovered a kind of roundabout shortcut to Union Station, which, you know, I had never even known existed. I've spent, you know, spent years hanging around in downtown LA. So there's always these weird little things that will reveal themselves to you, whether it's geographic or whether it's social or cultural. I agree. I mean, I think one of the things for me when I first got here, I had a lot of trouble with Los Angeles because I was expecting it to have or conform to some kind of linear narrative in the way that, say, a city like New York, for me at least, did. And I resisted the fact, or I resisted sort of accepting the fact that it didn't really cohere on those terms. It was only after I'd been here for a while and I started realizing that, in fact, it was the chaos of the city that was, in fact, its order, that I began to kind of get a sense of it. And that, in that sense, we're all kind of creating our own version of Los Angeles as we live in it and move through it. I think that's also true of other cities, but in Los Angeles, because of both the sprawl and the decentered nature of the city, and in many ways the fact that its boundaries are fairly indefinable. You know, there's LA City, there's LA County, there's all the kind of independent cities that sit inside Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, Santa Monica, Culver City, Inglewood, you know, that are bounded by the city. You know, we don't even quite have a definition of what Los Angeles is. But I also think that in the last decade or so, that's begun to shift, and that we are starting to see, and I think partly this has to do with public transportation, and partly it has to do with the resurgence of downtown, and partly it has to do with terminal gridlock and the kind of our return in a certain way out of both, I think, philosophy and necessity to thinking about the city in terms of its neighborhoods, that there has become, at least I've become aware of, much more of a sense of kind of place, of Los Angeles as kind of possessing much more of a kind of sense of place or sort of Los Angeles identity that sort of supersedes these this variety of communities. And I think that that's a really interesting tension between, you know, the sprawl on the one hand and the city of neighborhoods on the other, the kind of coherent identity on the one hand and the sort of order out of chaos on the other. And I think that that's sort of where we are now. That's one of the reasons that, you know, Los Angeles continues to be sort of endlessly fascinating to me. But what's currently fascinating me is this sort of shift or this sort of hybrid moment that the city seems to be occupying.
Is that was that some of the impetus for your latest book, Sidewalking?
You know, yeah, it turned into it. It's interesting. I've been thinking about sidewalking for I always walked. I mean, from the moment I moved here, again, partly out of necessity, because when we first moved here for the first few years, we were here, my wife and I were sharing one car. So often, and I was, you know, sort of freelancing and kind of my schedule was more flexible. So I often was without the car. And so I walked also because, you know, again, from how the cities that I had lived in, which were mostly, you know, walking cities, it was one of the fundamental ways I engaged with urban space. But it never really occurred to me to write a book about it until I'd been here for about 10 years or so, and I started writing essays about walking in the city. And then I thought, you know, maybe there's an investigation here. So the original impulse was really to write a book about walking, just purely about walking. I mean, the book is still kind of walking-centered, but I wanted to just write a book about walking and really make it the model. The early model was Alfred Kazin's book, A Walker in the City, which is a memoir about growing up in Brooklyn, but where he's really sort of describing his coming to identity as part of the process of walking the city streets. But then I'm slow and I'm kind of, I procrastinate. And so, first of all, the book sort of, you know, this is when I was originally thinking about the book in, say, like 2007, which is sort of before this kind of new LA, or at the very beginning of this kind of new LA coming into some sort of consciousness of itself. And then as I kind of sort of played with the ideas, but also was doing a ton of other stuff and didn't quite get to it and wasn't really ready to write it, the city changed. And so I got really interested in those changes that the city was going through. And so that shifted the focus of the book. So it was still, as I say, it's still centered in many ways by the idea of walking and certainly by the idea of neighborhoods, but a lot of the material that the book ended up addressing, because by the time I finally sat down to write it, which was 2013, 2014, the city had radically changed from what it was when I had first begun to conceptualize the book, and my relationship to the city had changed. So the book, or the ideas driving the book, had to evolve in a certain way as those things evolved.
And you said earlier in our conversation when you first came to LA that there was kind of this sense of a, you called it a shadow culture of literature. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in these interviews that I've been doing and kind of like becoming aware myself of the world of literature, I'm not just talking about writers, because there have always been writers that are from LA or based in LA, but the world of literature itself, smaller presses starting to gain more notoriety. Do you feel like this Los Angeles coming into consciousness of with itself is helping that literary world grow?
I'm hopeful. I mean, I think it's a really interesting and complicated question. So to break it down in a couple ways, I think Los Angeles has always been, as you say, literary culture is not just about writers. Los Angeles has always been, a really great writer's landscape going back to, you know, certainly to the beginning of the 20th century, end of the 19th century, for a variety of reasons. I mean, one of the early drivers was Hollywood, which pulled out a lot of writers, who came to cash in and then sort of either hung around or wrote about the place or wrote from the place. And that also created a kind of, but that also created a kind of sense of the literature of the city as a literature of exile. People from elsewhere who commented on the city or compared it, usually unfavorably, to the cities or the areas that they had come from. And then at a certain point, the critical mass shifted, late 60s, early 70s, probably. Most, you know, for me, the cornerstone writer in that shift is Wanda Coleman, who really began in the 1960s and then early 70s writing from out of the city as place. And I think the literature begins to become a literature of place at that point, a more homegrown literature. The other advantage for being a writer is that because the literary culture was, or, you know, has operated under the radar traditionally, it allows an enormous amount of freedom, for me at least, as a writer. It allowed me to explore things that I might not have explored if I was in a more self-conscious literary culture where I felt that people were looking over my shoulder. It allowed me to fail, sometimes in public, sometimes in private, and I think that's a huge benefit for any writer, any artist, is, you know, you need to be able to fail. You need to be able to fail, you know, pretty spectacularly sometimes, which I have certainly done. As far as the bigger question about the literary culture, literary infrastructure, I don't know the answer to that question yet. I think that there are some really interesting, interesting developments, whether in terms of cultural centers or bookstores or presses, that have sprung up in the last several years. I think of, you know, the last bookstore, Certainly A26, which is a satellite of a San Francisco organization, but nonetheless, you know, active and present in the city's culture. I think of a press like, you know, full disclosure, I'm actually publishing a book with them, but I think of a press like Unnamed Press, which is an independent press operating out of Eagle Rock that just celebrated its second anniversary and has published 15 or so books in those 2 years. So I think there is a kind of energy and a kind of movement, but I also think that, you know, Los Angeles, for whatever reason, has never really supported a publishing infrastructure. There have never been, you know, a vast amount of literary magazines, for instance, or even trade magazines that come out of Los Angeles, and the ones that do often don't survive for long periods of time. There aren't, you know, there are certainly publishers here, but not the mass of publishers you might expect from a city of this size and this diversity. San Francisco, which has traditionally been the West Coast's publishing center, in many ways still kind of holds that role. And so I don't know. I mean, I wonder about that. That's something I don't have an answer to, but it is something I've observed. I'm hopeful that we're sort of reaching or approaching some kind of critical mass, but I don't think we're there yet.
Now, your role at the Times as a book critic has recently expired, and do you see that playing into your answer? Because it seems like there's a little paring down that's happening with the Times as far as their book section.
Well, I think the book section is still what it was. I mean, in terms of what they're putting out, it's certainly still what it's what it's been. They're putting out the same stuff that as the paper is putting out the same volume of coverage as they have over the last several years. For me, to be honest, it was a purely personal decision. I had been wanting to make a shift for a while. As I said before, I really love writing criticism. It's part of my practice. I consider it to be really useful in many ways. Useful both sort of creatively and also aesthetically. I have no intention of not writing criticism, but I was, I wanted to shift my focus a bit, and the timing was right. I had won a fellowship at Guggenheim last year, so that was sort of sitting there. I was writing more of my own essays. I was writing more books. I was working more on books, and it was just a lot. I was also focusing much more energy on teaching, which I really enjoy and find deeply nourishing. So when the Times announced that they were offering buyouts, the timing was just right for me. It was a way of making it work both financially and of also clearing up more space in my life for me to be able to kind of sit and work on my own project. So the departure was for purely personal reasons. I loved working there, and I thought it was, you know, just in terms of, you know, some of the opportunities that it provided me in terms of both, you know, both in terms of journalistic opportunities, but also to have that long ongoing conversation about books with the readers of the paper, with the readers in the city, was something that I wasn't really consciously aware of expecting when I took the job, and that relationship with those readers, that ongoing relationship with those readers, is the most rewarding thing.
I'd like to talk a little bit about your book, The Lost Art of Reading, too, because that's another thing, you know, through these interviews and through kind of like throwing myself headfirst into this literary world, is this question of how reading and literature is changing with the times, and not just the medium of what you're reading on, but the younger generation and how they're approaching books, and books are produced at a higher quantity than ever before, but is the readership still there? I'd like to know what you think on that.
My sense is that the readership is still there. I mean, I think, you know, yes, books are being produced at a ridiculous rate and kind of overwhelming, you know, more books are whatever. I think we're close to 500,000 books are being published in the United States at this point. And I think really Henry Miller once wrote that, you know, the most voracious reader probably could read 5,000 books in a lifetime, you know, so I have no idea whether that number is accurate, but it sounds right. So if we think about 500,000 books a year and 5,000 books in a lifetime, you begin to see kind of the dichotomy of scale. I don't think reading is significantly under threat. I don't think reading has ever been significantly under threat. I have always thought, and I think that the numbers are starting to bear me out, that all of these kind of questions about the death of reading, the death of publishing, are just panic-driven on the one hand or clickbait-driven on the other hand, that they're not accurate and not truthful. You know, when ebooks came in, everybody thought that that was going to be the end of print. And ebooks have basically, you know, plateaued at about 25% of the market. You know, the younger generation, whatever, the millennials or even the generation after them, are apparently, at least according to studies I've read, reading increasingly on paper because it's a way of reading without distraction. I also don't have any problem with electronic reading. I mean, I think wherever you do reading is fine. And in many ways, there's a great piece that my former colleague Hector Tovar wrote a few years ago at the Times where he, you know, there was a study released which suggested that especially in developing countries where access to libraries and bookstores is sporadic at best, that the digital book revolution was huge in terms of both availability and access and also literacy because people were able to read on their phones. And so, you know, from my point of view, anything that gets more books or more text or more writing into the hands of more readers is a good thing. I think it's really important to remember that, you know, I don't believe that there was ever a golden age of reading. I don't actually believe that there was ever a golden age of anything. And, you know, when I was a kid coming up, I was someone who would hole up on a Saturday afternoon on the couch and read, you know, for a few hours. But most of my friends weren't. They were out doing stuff. And certainly, you know, Saturday night, we were going out and, you know, to parties or doing whatever, going to see music. We were not sitting around and having like deep literary conversations. I had some of the friends who were doing that, but even, you know, then, and you know, that was late 1970s. So I think that there is this sense that somehow we are always living in a degraded moment, you know, the fallout from some kind of perceived golden age. I understand the roots of that as a fantasy, but I don't see it as a reality. And I think that, you know, if you look at sort of, you know, NEA reports on reading and the numbers of people who are reading, even according to the NEA's kind of narrowly defined sense of literary, what literary writing means, there are, you know, they're talking about close to 100 million people doing some form of so-called literary reading each year. I would say it's more than that because I think this, their criteria is too narrow. But I don't think reading has ever been at risk.
I'm going to finish up with one more question. So you're going to be the judge for the Plaza Literary Prize, but also as a book critic. What are some of the things that you look for in a book, I mean, in a story? What are some of the things that make a book jump out to you or catch your attention?
I want to be surprised, and I want to be surprised in an authentic way. So I would say authenticity. I mean, if we're going to boil it down to a couple of words, I would say authenticity on the one hand and discovery. I want a sense of a writer discovering something. I don't want the sense of something that was canned or contrived or fully thought out. I mean, of course, all art is contrived. It has to be. That's part of its nature. But I think, you know, I want some version of what I have sometimes called the living line, a sense of a writer learning something about the story he or she is telling through the process of the telling, some element of discovery or excitement in the language, some turn of narrative or phrase that is both unpredictable and utterly right. You know, I want to feel a kind of tension. I want to feel that the writer knows what he or she is doing in the sense of how to conduct the exploration. But I also don't want the sense that the writer had it all figured out when they started. You know, to me, this is partly my sort of process as a writer, too. I start with a lot of ideas and a lot of intentions, but I also start with a lot of open questions and a lot of things I don't know and a lot of things I don't want to know and things that emerge through the writing. This is not to say that I want a messy first draft that is just constantly all over the place. I think often that is the case with a first draft, and then the writer goes in and hones it and shapes it and finds those things that, you know, he or she wasn't expecting, but that now seem or must seem inevitable because it's how the, you know, how the narrative has resolved, and you can bring them up or put them down or, you know, figure out what the mix is in some way. But at the center of it, I think, is still that matter of discovery. What made you write this? And for me, the answer is never an answer. It's always a question. And the question may or may not get resolved. The question gets addressed, but the question may or may not get resolved. In fact, some of my favorite writings are ones in which the question doesn't get resolved because it's an unresolvable question. I don't really believe in epiphany as a, I guess it worked for Joyce, but I don't really believe in epiphany as an aesthetic strategy, or frankly, as a life strategy. And so I'm mostly interested in writing that wrestles with questions.
Is there something that you want to find at the beginning of the book, like that hook, the thing that continues, or could there be books that have that slow burn and find you midway or closer to the end? Or
I think both. I mean, I try very hard to enter a piece of writing as a reader with as little preconception as possible. So this is true even with a published book. I rarely read, even when I was reviewing, I never read press materials. I didn't read the PR stuff. I didn't read the one sheets. I don't read jacket copy. I don't read the descriptions. I don't read the blurbs. I'm primarily interested in as direct and unfiltered an engagement with the written text as is possible. So in that way, I feel the same about, say, reading unpublished work, or reading for a contest, or reading student work, or reading anything. I want to be as open to what the writer is trying to do as possible, and then I will assess my reaction, which may, I may like it, I may not, but I want to be able to assess my reaction on the basis of that direct interaction or that direct engagement, and have as little of the kind of mitigating or filtering materials in play. And certainly there's some works that I've loved that, it takes them 75 pages to get rolling, and some works that grab me from the first sentence. Thomas Mann's novel, Dr. Faustus, as an example, which I think is a great novel, I struggled through the first 350 pages of that book until I got to the magnificent final 150 pages of the book. I'm glad I didn't bail out, because I wouldn't have had the payoff. And so that doesn't always happen. It's a lot to ask, and other people may have a very different reaction to that book. But I want the book to grab me where the book grabs me, and I want to be able to see at the end, look back at the end, and see what the writer was doing and how they pulled it off or didn't.
Well, David, thank you so much for taking the time to talk. It was a great, informative conversation, and thank you for participating with the Plaza Literary Prize as well.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for a great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
This has been the How the Why by 1888. I'm John Barrett Ingalls. The show is produced by Kevin Stanek and yours truly, with production assistance by Sarah Becker. The music is Maya Lua by Bossa Zuzu. I wanted to thank everybody for your creativity and your inspiration, and to remind you all to keep making art. Thank you.